Thank you all for being here today for our Public Health Advisory Council meeting. So, you know, we always start with the roll call and to identify if we have a quorum. Lydia, do you still want me to do that? I know you said we have a quorum.
I think it's always nice just to say hello. So, yeah, it might be a good idea.
Okay. All right. So we'll start with the roll call. So I'm just going to read the names of our members and just please let us know if you are present. So we'll start with Elma Bloom.
Present.
Karen Bowerman.
Hello.
John Brooks. And I know Sandy's not going to be here today. Shauna Carter. Peggy Carlson.
I'm here.
Tyler Clary.
Hello, I'm present.
Paul Childers.
Here.
Mark Collier.
Here.
Heather Decker.
Here.
Remy Youson.
Here.
Adrienne Fairbanks.
Present.
Dave Fuller. Oh, and I believe Dave is not going to be here today either. Amy Gross.
I'm here.
Stephanie Royce Yamashita.
I'm here.
Marla Sanger. I know Marla's here. I think you were still muted, Marla. Andy Santos.
Hello.
Cassandra Sellers-Reck. Michelle Stickley. And Maria Swinger-Inskeep.
Present.
Okay. And I know we have our public health staff joining us with Alan, Roxanne, Lydia, Jeff, and am I missing anyone? And Brian. Sorry, Brian. I'm trying to look at all the little squares on my Zoom call.
Did you mention Andrea?
Yep. And Andrea. Okay. All right. Also, do we have any guests at the meeting today? And if we do, please state your name and if you're representing an organization. Okay. No guests today.
Can I ask a question about attendance? This is Maria. If we have a sector who they are regularly not attending the meeting, do you guys reach out to them and see if they're open to sending an alternate or where, why people aren't attending? I noticed one particular area, so I wasn't sure.
You know, I don't have a great answer for that. I'll let the public health staff take that.
So I believe, I have to take a look at the bylaws again. Maybe my team can remind me, but I think I think we do have a policy, or it's in the bylaws in terms of multiple absences. But again, I'd have to take a look at that. I think, you know, the first step is when somebody's absent a lot is to reach out to them and see if we can get them, you know, find out whether there's a problem there and get them to return. But if not, and they miss multiple meetings, I think there's a, I believe it's in the bylaws, because I know we'd addressed this before. Roxanne, you were nodding your head. Is that the case?
Yeah, we definitely have a process, and we can certainly make that available, kind of outline it, make that available in our notes to the committee about kind of how we try to support the group. But I know it's difficult sometimes. This is not the most convenient time, and we appreciate all the volunteers for taking their time and participating. So,
Thank you. So moving on to, let's just move on to reviewing or actually approving the May meeting notes. Can I get a motion, please, for approval of previous meeting notes? And please say your name.
This is Paul. I approve.
Okay. And can I get a second?
Seconded, Clary.
And anyone all in favor? Anyone opposed? Please state your name so we have a count. Okay, great. Thank you. Let's move on to just reviewing the agenda really quickly. So we've got a pretty packed agenda today, and I know Lydia sent this out ahead of the meeting. As the Executive Council met a couple of weeks ago, we come up with the agenda ahead of the meeting. So we wanted to talk about COVID-19 and a monkeypox update, racial equity process status, foundational public health services, looking through the organizational chart and positions, a budget update, an ethics review of the free fridge program, and also wanted to talk about scheduling public comments. There is something that, as PAC Executive Council, Michelle and I wanted to make sure we had some room to talk about today, which is actually talking through some of the public health implications and the role of public health in our community around the recent repeal of Roe v. Wade. So we will get into that as part of our agenda today. I think I'd like us to start with that and then move on to the rest of the agenda. Before I do that, though, I don't believe we have anyone from the public here. But just checking to make sure if there is, and if anyone is here to provide public comment, which we're limiting to 2 minutes, just given time constraints. Okay, all right, well then let's get started. So I'm sure, everyone is aware of the recent Supreme Court decision repealing Roe v. Wade. I know that this is a very controversial, very political topic, but I'm hoping that as PAC, we can set some of the politics aside and just focus on the, I'm sorry, I don't know, we're getting a lot of feedback. If you're not talking, could you please mute your speakers or your microphones? So again, as PAC, I'm hoping we can set politics aside and just really try to focus today on some of the public health aspects of this recent decision. A couple of the things that Michelle and I really wanted to make sure we had the space and the room to talk about today was if public health should put out a statement that despite the recent decision from the Supreme Court, abortion does continue to be legal in the state of Washington, and also including a list of resources on where abortion can be accessed in the state of Washington. Kind of a bigger question, too, is, should public health, put out a statement talking about some of the public health implications around this decision, particularly around equity, which, has been a big part of our work, I think, as PAC, and that our public health department is really, I think, very engaged and focused on. So, again, I know this can be, a very thorny issue, but I think it's an important issue for us to talk about. We are PAC. We are making recommendations to our Board of Health, and so I wanted to see if, Michelle, did you have anything you wanted to add to this?
Yes, and I thank you for being so patient. I'm at the school with my kids. And, you know, I am concerned. I've had some community members come to me and ask if public health would be, and the advisory council would be issuing a statement. So thank you for entertaining this conversation, Aru, with me and the rest of the staff members. This is, you know, obviously something that's very difficult for us to find a middle ground on. But I think that as members and leaders of the community, that we do show support for people that are in a position that may need to utilize these services. Whether they come here to Washington to seek services, something like that, or whatever the concern may be or the need might be, without judgment, without malice. And I personally would support staff and public health to issue a statement. So with that, I'd like to open up discussion, Aru, with your support.
I have a question. This is Paul. I know that Governor Inslee has indicated that this is a we're legal here in the state of Washington, and it was my understanding that Oregon and California were joining along. Have they committed themselves also? Because all I know is what I heard Governor Inslee reported over TV the other day.
Right now, what I do know about Washington, Oregon, and California, I believe it's like dubbed the West Coast Offense. It's basically the three states coming together to basically stand together to show that although other states are going to be shutting down or basically making it illegal to get an abortion, Washington, Oregon, and California, that it's still very much legal, and they will also help people that come into the states to get an abortion. That's what I know about the whole three states.
That's what I heard.
Yes.
So we'd love to have some discussion from FAC around what the advisory council thinks and how we feel about, you know, issuing the statement, particularly around the fact that, you know, abortion is legal in Washington, in Clark County. Here's a list of resources for those, you know, looking to access this service, and any concerns or questions that anyone on the council may have about, you know, such a statement. And also, I really just want to make sure that this is, you know, a safe place for us, you know, to talk about this, because I know this can be a difficult topic for us to engage in. So I will stop talking and open up the floor for discussion.
I like the idea. Andy, where are you going?
Yeah, I was about to say something like, no worries, you can go first.
I was just going to say, I like the idea. I think it's important. I think people might be confused and think it's illegal now. And I think for FAC to put out a statement reiterating that abortion is still safe and legal in this state, I think I would support that.
This is Paul. I would support it also.
I would support it with as far as Peggy and Paul that you just stated. I don't think it's necessary to go into the detail of here's who you can contact to get an abortion, because that is something that, first of all, it's a state's issue. And even though there are plenty of places in Clark County that abortions can be obtained, if you think it's important to list them on our website, we could do that and then reference that in whatever kind of a press release we're talking about here. But as far as
suggesting, I mean, you're talking about this as being a sensitive issue, but frankly not treating it in that way. Because if you treat it as a sensitive issue, you do talk about other services for pregnancy that are available that don't involve abortion. And I'm not sure that FACT needs to get into all of that. So if you want to reference where you can get an abortion in Clark County on the website, I think that would suffice. That's my opinion.
Good opinion.
Thank you. I agree with you, Councilwoman. I do think where is a little excessive, and I think that if people are looking for that those services, they can. What do you think, Council? What are your thoughts on that?
I think the places could be listed in that are available in Clark County on the public health website. But also maybe there is someone within public health who would be a good contact person. And that individual and their phone number could be listed as well.
Council Chair Bauman, we can list, and Ashley was thinking that, it's consistent with what, you know, when DOH has put out announcements about whatever they are, it's consistent that we've shared those. So we can share that information, which has places where people can go on our website. And we can probably put that on our social media as well, which we generally do when DOH issues something.
About how many are there in Clark County that would be listed?
Does anybody know the answer?
We can do a scrub of how many clinics currently provide a suite of obstetric and gynecological services. And to your point, there's a range of available options, and our staff who implement and provide support for pregnant and parenting families do offer all available resources, which is inclusive of, but not limited to, abortion, as is legal in the state. And so we partner with a range of folks across the region to that effect.
And we can provide a contact information there, correct, Andrea?
Yes.
And that's someone within our own department, right? Yeah, that would be terrific.
My biggest question to this statement that would be going out is, are we sure that it'll reach the entire audience that we want to reach? Sorry, there's a car passing right behind my window. Are we sure it'll reach everyone that we want it to reach? I'm thinking more along people that are my age and younger. I'm 18 right now. I just graduated high school, and I know normally when big contentious issues are going on, school has always been sort of a safety net for people with families that have opposing ideals or opposing beliefs. And right now, since overturning Roe v. Wade happened, right once everyone kind of got out of school, everyone's kind of back at home, there's bound to be more contention. There's bound to be more infighting amongst family dynamics. So are we able to kind of reach those people? That's one of my concerns. Because I've talked to a lot of people that are my age, sometimes even younger, that are really, really struggling with just intense pressure from either viewpoints coming from their families.
Andy, I'm curious, do you have any ideas, thoughts on, like, what would be the best way to reach, the 18-year-olds or the younger adults? Since I imagine you know more about what is the best way to, you know, to reach them than myself, who, you know, I'm not 18.
Right now, it's kind of one of those tricky situations of not creating an echo chamber around yourselves, because as much as, like, I want to feel confident in myself to post something on my own social media, my social media is typically surrounded by other people that probably have the same ideals and beliefs as me. Because whenever I start posting things, with sites, with infographics, with different more, with more resources, I typically notice that my follower count, it diminishes because people are typically tending to block me or unfollow me, which I'm fine with, but I do understand that does create an echo chamber around me. So right now, I can't exactly think of anything off the top of my head, but I can think of one of the places it could, I could post some places, because like I know that we have a system set up where people that don't have food at their house have the ability to go into schools to pick up food. I know there's quite a few around my area, so we can set something up around that, because the overturning of Roe v. Wade, it does disproportionately target those that are already on sort of the poverty line and are already, how do I say it, they're going to be affected at a disproportionate amount. I can get in contact with some of my friends that are still in high school, that are still in activist leadership roles right now, to see what could be going on right there. Because I do know that certain organizations are meeting outside of school right now.
One of the things we, that's also a possibility, and anything with communications can be really, really challenging. And I think Peggy put something in the chat about does FAC have social media presence? And so, you know, one option is too, is, you know, your role as FAC members, you can certainly forward information to your networks. And, you know, we can certainly post to our social media pages, Twitter, Instagram, those things. And, you know, and make sure you are in the loop, and you know, if you have other areas, other conversations you'd like to have in the community with your networks, you could certainly do that. So that's a
to reiterate. A lot of the times,
Go ahead, Andy. Sorry.
Oh, that a lot of the times people are just simply unaware of any resources that we do have available to us, even during school. Because do you guys remember how there's a CMAR clinic set up? I think it was either at Evergreen or in like close proximity to Evergreen High School. Almost nobody knew about that, even though it's such a huge resource. So I'm just looking for different ways to reach out, and I was hoping to see if FAC fell under any of those resources that could be put out there.
I think your question certainly demands additional dialogue with our healthcare partners and allied health professionals as it relates to this specific issue. I know in terms of the messaging, to Roxanne and Michelle's point, a lot of our community partners are looking to public health as a discipline to provide context and support for the standing of abortion in the state of Washington right now. And I know that some of our key partners, the Southwest Washington Equity Coalition and the YWCA, are interested in collaborating on joint statements and policy action in support of our community to this effect, knowing that this is a complex issue with intergenerational implications of the choices and the resources that we provide. Would it be beneficial if we put together some messaging back to FAC for review, in addition to a mock-up of what our website resources could look like, as well as a contact? Is that something that would be valuable for the group?
I definitely think that would be valuable. There's also an additional point to be made that a part that a lot of people may not also completely understand or know about the overturning of Roe v. Wade, it doesn't just have to do with abortion, but it also has to do with the strengthening of, I believe it's our 14th Amendment, our right to privacy. So with that, like, sort of being overturned and, like, that being weakened, does that mean anything for public health right now? about that weakening right to privacy when it comes to our medical records, when it comes to just our interpersonal relationships, or even just being on this council in itself? Or is that just asking too many questions that we don't have the answers to?
I think they're fundamental and critical questions, and you're asking absolutely all the right questions. And I think a lot of the questions you ask, there's some really smart people trying to figure out what the potential implications of reversing Supreme Court decisions can have on our existing right to privacy, bodily autonomy, the relationships we hold, what's legal, what's not legal, and what that means through the context and lens of population or public health, right? And so we have data that clearly supports implications of the reversal of Roe versus Wade on different portions of our population, right? Different groups of people, and we study, that's what the study of public health is. So we know what our position is in terms of support of positive health outcomes and the reduction of morbidity and mortality to this end. So I think in terms of public health law and ethics, that is a complex question. And I think that's probably outside of the immediate scope of this group. But I think that there's lots of people that are trying to figure out what the downstream implications of future court decisions, Supreme Court decisions, will have on our community, right? And if our goal is to secure and preserve and to promote and to improve public health in our community, how can we essentially ensure that we are being good stewards of our role as public health practitioners and advisory council members as we receive information and move those things forward? It's a non-answer answer, but there's a lot to unpack there, and it'll depend on future decisions for sure.
I understand. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Andrew, this is Michelle. Going back to a mock-up, could we add a CDC link on there as well?
Yeah, I think we could review. Could you send me the CDC link, or Roxanne, the CDC's a link, so Marissa can take a look at it?
I think the CDC link was a good link, and there was a couple of other ones that I had taken a look at, but I think the CDC was a good one. Those are the ones that I think the public, would most likely go to. And if we have it just all in one spot.
And see, Marla has her hand raised. Go ahead, Marla.
Thank you. There's a couple things that come to mind. I'm hearing a lot of really important questions, and I think that they deserve the discernment of this group. And I wonder if would it work to have people submit the questions to Lydia, and then, I don't know if we can take care of all of them right now, probably not. But, and then see where there's overlap and try to narrow it down to the ones that we think are distinct and fall within our potential scope, and then maybe bring it back to this group, or maybe have a separate, if there wants to be a small group to address it. I don't think we need to reinvent the wheel. There's a lot of work going on in this right now, and I think our role is to be mindful of the people that we're here to serve, which is our communities, and to be able to point folks maybe in the right direction. I also think it's really important, and I'm not saying point them to a direction to get an abortion or get other services with parenting, but just to say that we can say, as a public health affiliated group, that we want to be aware of what exists within our realm. So that would be one aspect of it. And then the second thing is, I really like the idea, I always prefer when there is something that affects our whole entire country, and there's some federal statement with respect to that, and the state has its own statement, and the county has a statement, and the city has a statement, and the unincorporated areas might have their own statement, it can become quite a maze for people in the community to sort through. So to the extent possible that we can either just use the state's statement that they're putting out and not create our own, I don't always think that it's less confusing to have consistency among the various, the people that are representing us and the people that are creating these messages for us. So that's all I wanted to add.
Anyone else with any other questions, concerns, suggestions?
This is Saru, this is Michelle. I would just like to add, and I hear what you're saying, Marla. And I think that maybe we go with something that Andrea had suggested in the collaboration and partnership with other organizations. Because I do understand what you're saying, that it's repetitive. And can be overwhelming and then maybe just kind of, overlooked by the community.
Well, I really appreciate everyone's viewpoints and suggestions. So it sounds like our next steps are to expect the draft of a statement from our public health staff. Is that right?
Well, one thing I heard is that we could go ahead. I heard earlier that we could go ahead and put the DOH statement on our website and on our social media with the location, that includes a location finder for services. So that was one thing I heard. And then the other piece is about a statement, and that would be this, I think, the second part of what you were all talking about earlier. And I'm hearing a couple of things about that. I'm hearing a public health statement versus signing on to other community statements.
The thing I would just add to that is my concern about many different agencies creating their own statement is that it can become white noise to the general public. And I have concern about that. I think simple is usually better, and consistency is helpful. So that's what I was just trying to suggest. That there is such a thing as too much information all at once. And to the extent possible that we can provide or utilize already existing messaging, unless it's counter to what we believe. But if the state has a message that we feel is consistent with what makes sense from our organization, the part that I'm more concerned about than anything is that that any messaging that's going to be agreed upon, that it has relevance to all of the different segments of our population, that it's not aimed only at one audience. Usually the Department of Health statements are pretty generic and able to, reach a large audience, and maybe that's not sufficient, but I think that communications is really tricky, and fortunately we have a communications expert on the public health team that I think can help us greatly in how to figure out the best path.
I just did a quick search on the Washington Public Health site just to see what would come up. What you say about white noise is very true. I mean, there's everything from mask wearing you know, to how to clean your fruits and vegetables too. And that's on a search for abortion. So, you know, I think we may even need some guidance when we're referencing the CDC and the Washington State site so that we get to the one that is really the most helpful for people. Is it? There's a lot of stuff that a search is not going to be very helpful on.
There's a statement that DOH put out. I could share my screen if folks want to see that. I think that is a DOH statement about it being legal and where you can get. So you want me to share that? I could show you that briefly so I can get this to work. Let's see. Does that come up? Can you see that?
Yes, see it.
So basically is a statement that you can see Department of Health put out talking about the fact that it's legal. You can legally have an abortion. You can decide to have a child. That you can make this decision even if you're under 18. It's legal. Where you can go, you know, how do I pay for it? How do I keep information about my abortion private? So that's the state. That would be what we would put on our website or on our, you know, and on our social media sites.
I think that would satisfy it.
I'll go ahead and do you want to read through it more, or is it you all have enough?
The only thing I see missing in this document is information related to the overturning of Roe versus Wade. Like, somebody may see this and think, oh, they haven't updated it since the Supreme Court reversed Roe v. Wade. Could add a sentence about, even though Roe v. Wade has been overturned in Washington, abortion remains legal?
Yeah, we could put that. When we post it on our website, as well as on our social media site, we could put a sentence in that the State Department of Health put this out after the Supreme Court decision. And, yeah, that would just take a sentence. We could do that.
Something that I've seen a lot of the times is just, it's pretty simple. It's like, post Roe v. Wade, what does this mean for blank? And then you just give an area, a state. That's what a lot of states are doing, like, post Roe v. Wade, what does this mean for the state of Oregon, Texas, Washington, California, New York? And then I've seen just like a list of that. So that is something we can start off with.
The other, I mean, if you know, I heard earlier about a statement, aside from this, we can put together some material of information and data is available, data that's out there about what this could mean in terms of health impacts from the information we have, and we could, you know, we could work on something like that. Just based on the, you know, what's in the literature.
Yeah, I like all those ideas, and I think, I feel like we have a good plan of, you know, just a simple one or two word sentence of, you know, post Roe v. Wade, you know, here's, however we want to word it, state of abortion services, or abortion continues to be legal in Washington State, in Clark County. And then we could just link to the Department of Health statements. And I think that will capture, hopefully, that we're talking about a post-Roe v. Wade world, but also to Marla and Karen's point of, you know, we're not adding to the hundreds of statements that are already out there and could just get lost in the mix.
So suggesting we put a link Sorry, I have a phone going in the background.
Oh, link or just have that show up on the website. Yeah.
I suspect DOH will be putting out more information on this as well. So maybe just linking to what DOH is putting out.
And it sounds like the CDC link as well. Is that right? So I think a couple of trusted places that people can go to. And I see there's a question in the chat from Heather. Is this an opportunity to also share Plan B resources?
I believe it should be, but not directly tied to the statement right off the bat. I believe that is something else that should be added. Maybe not like right off the bat, because a lot of the times, poor sex education is a stem of a lot of these issues, because even in our school, so I've literally been through, I can show on one hand. Actually, I can show on less than three fingers how many times we had conversations about Plan B, about contraceptives, and that they were just simply not there. I remember making a poster about Plan B my freshman year, and after that, that was it, and that was 4 years ago. Besides that, our curriculum is normally focused around abstinence, which is definitely not applicable to the vast majority of just people because they have different beliefs and viewpoints. So I do think it does present the opportunity to showcase more contraceptives. We shouldn't tie it directly to the statement that's being made due to the fact that people may just view it and be like, it's still legal, okay, that's all the information I need, and not read anything else or not bother to check anything else out. So to not overwhelm the common reader that's going to view this.
Yeah, but what are we defining as Plan B? Are we defining Plan B? Heather, I don't know, I guess you're the one that asked the question, but I think are we offering up the other alternatives besides abortion is what I'm thinking here. You can't just, I feel like we're almost making a political statement if we just say there's only access to abortion, just, you know, clinics you can go to, instead of saying here are the other things that are available within Clark County that you can go to if you're just looking for resources for pregnancy.
I think our website has all the resources, including alternatives. I believe that's on there. I'll have to double check, but it's been up there for a while in terms of health resources, including reproductive health resources.
Yeah, and I was more thinking in lines of, I think I had heard many people think that Plan B was going to be affected by the overturning of Roe versus Wade. So just to clarify that.
The FDA is actually trying to deal with that, because in some states they're trying to ban the use of Plan B. But again, those are also in the states that are criminalizing abortions. So I do not believe that anything is going to happen in Washington.
Yeah, we do have a website under our family planning page that references and directs folks how to get access to a range of parenting and reproductive resources, but it's not tied to anything new in terms of the reversal of Roe v. Wade.
Can we include maybe with our initial statement, because I think it is important for that initial statement to just be very clear that we're talking about access to abortion post Roe v. Wade, but at the end of the statement, like, could we have like a sentence or two that says, if you have questions about you know, contraception or Plan B and how that may be affected in post Roe v. Wade, you know, here is a link, and we could link to our public health website. And so it's not something that is potentially kind of confusing for people to look at. And I think then the statement is very clear. But then there's also room for additional resources. You know, if someone is wondering, okay, abortion's legal, but what about Plan B or what about, you know, contraception? We could include that maybe at the end of our statement.
We can also include the statement, you know, the statement that we just talked about on the family planning page that we can do both. We can include that on the family planning page that Andrea is referring to as well. You're muted, Aru.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can.
No. How does FAC feel about that?
I think the family planning page is a good place for it. If that's what you're asking, Ellen.
So I think what we're hearing is FAC is supportive of us sharing the DOH resources that are out there right now with links to information about reproductive health on our website and on our social media, which we can move forward with relatively soon if you all are supportive of that. The second, go ahead, Dr. Melnick.
Yeah, I just found we also have on our webpage right now, there's a question, where can I get Plan B? So that's already on our webpage.
Okay.
We have a question for that. I just wanted to add that because that question came up.
Okay. And then the second thing we're going to do is go back and look at a more thorough draft statement that we can bring back to the group to consider support for that. And I think Cassie has her hand up. Cassie?
I just wanted to be supportive of what you're saying. I have a 17-year-old daughter, and, you know, I'm a critical care nurse at the hospital. You know, we're in a pandemic. We are in a war with, you know, assisting in a war. And then this craziness happens. I can say that my daughter has been confused, and there's a lot of young women who have concerns and feel attacked, and now Indigenous women who already suffer with the racism and stigma that, you know, the other political party brings now feel like their rights, you know. So I just wanted to speak in favor of all the transparency and resources because our young women do need to be supported during this time. And I know Indigenous women have issues where sterilization happened and these other inhumane practices, and so to feel as though we've gone back, to have this openness and support is very meaningful. And so I just wanted to say that, and also say that I lift up my hands to you from Maui. So thank you.
Thank you, Cassie. Okay, well, it is almost 6:20. I know we have other items on the agenda. Is there any other pressing questions or concerns about this before we move on?
Can we just summarize just real briefly? It sounds like we'll go ahead and post the DOH statement both on our webpage, including the links to our family planning information. And we'll post it on social media as well. And then we're going to be working on maybe links to future statements that come from DOH, perhaps CDC. And we can also work on putting some other information together as well that we can share for your review.
Yeah. Sounds good, Alan.
Okay, well, so we'll work on another statement with some data that we'll bring to FAC. Okay.
Okay.
because we like your support on this.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for that discussion. Alan, did you want to, so moving on to the next agenda items, Alan, did you want to give us a brief update on COVID-19 and monkeypox?
Muted myself. I'll be as brief as possible. So, so the statewide, the case and hospitalization rates have decreased slightly after the latest wave that picked in, that we had in mid-May, but have not, since then, they kind of went down and then they've kind of leveled out. It is still a fairly high rate. And by the way, in the numbers we're talking about, you can multiply them by probably a factor of 5 when I give you numbers, because many people are having, or most people are testing over the counter and not reporting when they have positive results. So it's estimated that, you know, less than 1 out of 5 are being reported, or close to that. Yeah. So that being said, with the numbers we have, the 7-day case rate through, the latest date that we have full data available is June 18th, and the state was at 228 cases per 100,000 over 7 days, down from 274 in mid-May, but still at a pretty high level. And that gets you into, you know, the CDC community levels. That puts you at least into the medium range. And the hospital admission rate since June 18th, through June 18th, over 7 days, is 7.9 per 100,000, and peak of May was 8.3, so it's gone down a little bit, but still fairly high. The reproductive number, you know, we want that to be below 1. If it's above 1, the case numbers are generally increasing. We were at 1.6 in early April. We're down to 1.06 as of May 24th, but that's still above the 1 number in terms of going down. And we want it to be well below 1. In terms of in Clark County, the 7-day case rate as of through June 18th is 166.7 per 100,000 over, you know, that's over 7 days. Down from a peak of 232 per 100,000, but you know, after that first Omicron wave that we had earlier with the trough, we were at 25 per 100,000. So we're still several times that amount at 166.7. Our hospitalization rate, actually higher than the state's, puts us in the medium range of community level. We're at 11.8. per 100,000 over 7 days. That is above the 10% that we'd like to see. We'd like to see below 10%. And as of last week, 11% of hospital beds were occupied by COVID-19 patients. We want that to be below 10%. So there's still a strain on our hospitals. You know now that both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are now available for children as young as 6 months. And the Pfizer vaccine is available for children 6 months through 4 years, and the Moderna vaccine is available for children 6 months to through 5 years and children 6 to 17-year-olds. They require either initial 2 or 3 dose series, depending on the vaccine. And of course, vaccines are still recommended for everybody 5 years of age and older as well. And then, I think we've already mentioned this, I know I repeat it, that some populations, people who are 50 and older, and people with underlying conditions or immunocompromised, should get a second booster 4 months after their first booster. Unfortunately, I keep on bringing this up, in Clark County, the number of people getting vaccinated and boosted has stalled. Only about 66%, just about two-thirds of Clark County residents have completed their primary vaccination series, and less than 60%, so more than 40% have not received, who are 12 and older, have not received a booster. So we need to really push and strongly support in getting our vaccination rates increased. We know that immunity wanes both after previous infection as well as after vaccination. So getting the boosters is really important. It helps prevent not only severe disease, but infection and transmission. So we really, really need to support those efforts, especially since we have a fairly large unvaccinated population. I'd also point out that infection-induced immunity, getting immunity through getting infected, is not a good strategy given what this virus can do. Okay, monkeypox. We're seeing a bit more monkeypox in the United States. It's, you know, that it's endemic to several Central and West African countries. Now worldwide, there's more than over 4,000 cases. In the United States, there have been 244 cases, including 4 cases in Washington State and 1 in Oregon. It doesn't spread easily. It can be spread through respiratory contact, but it's often spread through direct contact with lesions, person to person, as well as you can get it from bedding or clothing that's been in contact with lesions that has material on it. You can get it that way as well. So direct contact, if you're getting through the respiratory route, it needs prolonged close contact. So it's not anything close to COVID-19 in terms of being contagious, but it can be spread, and it's got about, I believe the variety we're seeing here has about a 1% mortality rate, although I don't know that there have been deaths reported yet in terms of the numbers in the United States. But people need to be aware of it. And the other point is we've got information out, and the feds have just released, making vaccine more available for people who have had high risk contact, people in risk risk situations. So we'll get more of that information out in terms of vaccines for people who are close contacts to confirm cases. That's about all I have on monkeypox.
Dr. Melnick, I have a question. I kind of lost track of what the proper protocol is when somebody tests positive for COVID. I mean, I had an employee test positive last week, and he came in yesterday, and I said, oh, are you negative? And he's like, well, I don't know. I didn't test, and all my symptoms are gone. And so I don't even know what we're supposed to be telling people to do.
Well, so he should be continuing to mask for 10 days. Was he doing that?
He was
not required to quarantine, but required to, you know, that, you know, he's a week out, not required to be isolated. He was a case, right? Not required if his symptoms are gone, but he should continue to mask for the 10 days.
Mask for 10 days after you no longer have symptoms or the onset of symptoms?
After the onset.
Okay.
I believe that's the most recent protocol. You know, it changes over time. So not isolating anymore. I mean, he's been asymptomatic, and he didn't test apparently after 5 days, but he should continue to mask for the full 10 days after exposure. I can get you the link to that. Let me work on that.
Thanks. Dr. Melnick, I wanted to ask, too, similar to this question, it's so interesting. How about when the person is asymptomatic but hasn't tested since the positive test, let's say, yesterday, and they haven't tested again? So do you just go with the asymptomatic issue and then let them fly with contact with others wearing a mask? Is that the deal, or do they need to retest?
I'm going to get you the isolation and quarantine guidelines here. So if you tested positive for COVID-19 and have symptoms, regardless of vaccination status, stay home for at least 5 days, and then wear a well-fitting mask if you must be around others in your home. Ending isolation if you've had symptoms. End isolation after 5 full days if you're fever-free for 24 hours. but take precautions, as I said earlier, until day 10, which means wear a well-fitting mask. So if you've had symptoms, you can end isolation after 5 full days if you're fever-free and your symptoms are improving. But you still have to wear a mask for the full 10 days. Is that answering? I don't know if I'm answering your question or not. Okay, the other thing is if you've not had any symptoms, which I think was the other question, is end isolation after at least 5 full days after your positive test. So if they tested positive yesterday, they should continue to isolate for 5 days. Then they can end, and they're asymptomatic, then they can end isolation, but they still have to wear a mask for the full 10 days since their positive test.
And we just went through this at our own house. My daughter just tested positive. But if their test, you know, kids start testing negative really quickly and they're asymptomatic. So if you have access to a test and they test negative, what's your thought? Do you think they're still shedding virus? I assume that they're not shedding virus if they're testing negative. But the CDC website doesn't really say, like, they don't have to wear a mask in public. It says wear a mask in public after 10 days.
They should continue. So, you know, you can have false negatives with the antigen test. I just want to, false positives are really rare, but you can have false negatives with the antigen test, you know, the over-the-counter test. So I think the best practice is to continue to wear a mask for 10 days.
So I have a quick, statement. I talked to a neighborhood COVID and she was elderly and didn't go to the doctor. And she didn't realize that all the residents, at least in Clark County, get 10 free COVID tests per month. Is there any way, who can I contact to maybe have the communications people just reiterate that? Because the tests we're getting are starting to expire. And then there's also a statement about that. But I feel like that's a resource that nobody seems to really know about. I heard about it from you, Dr. Melnick.
I think we have information on our website about where you can get tests. I have to go to our website pretty quickly, but I think the information.
I think a reminder, maybe once a month.
Put that out. Okay.
Or once every other month would be nice, just so, because people get it and they're like, you know, why spend $20 at the store when you can get them for free?
We can get more we can get a reminder about that, and we can put
I think that'd be helpful.
Okay. Sounds good.
Any other COVID or monkeypox related questions for Dr. Melnick?
Guys are all going to stump me. Trying to keep in my head all the guidelines and all that. I'm trying to become a savant here. But the recommendation is masking for 10 days. Sorry.
Andrea, did you want to give us a quick update on racial equity process, the status?
Yes, happily. So I think not last meeting, but 2 meetings ago, I shared kind of the raw results of our Clark County baseline survey for our staff. We're finalizing what the visual presentation of this will look like, and then we're going to get it pushed out to all of our staff so they can review the data, and then the summary analysis by our health assessment and evaluation teams. And immediate next steps will include convening our EDIG groups of the Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion group to discuss the formatting and the content upload for our public-facing website. We also had some outreach from some community members, so I'll be meeting with them in July, and we're actually going to use that as an opportunity to kind of share our journey, some of the resources that we're using as we're tracking down additional funding for like the formal facilitation processes, and some of the resources that I shared with you all a couple months ago from the racism as the ultimate underlying health condition from the APHA. and really going to use that planning session to also solicit feedback from that group to say, okay, in terms of content, what are you looking for when you come to public health in terms of guidance or resources or tools, and to really kind of start having a more in-depth dialogue about how we can leverage existing local, state, and national-based resource from a public health perspective. So that's taking place. And then in August, we're going to plan to do an all-staff review and a facilitated session with the organization regarding the results, and make time and space to reflect on a lot of the qualitative analysis. Apologies, my dog's decided, like, this is the time to really start playing. They're running out of quiet energy. I'm sorry. I'm like wrestling. Take them outside. This is a safe space, right? So that's going to happen in August. And so we'll also be working with our team to walk through what type of questions we want to ask staff, and how to really move the conversation forward. And then ideally we'll begin our training session using that 6-part, 1.5-hour each webinar series with our leadership team, EDIC and management, and move that forward through 2023. And then just to kind of pull the thread of the next agenda item, there's something that I'm incredibly excited about. Is it okay if I pre-introduce this? So we received approval from our human resources department to onboard a deputy director position. And part of this work really demands excellent facilitation and expert understanding of the evolving discipline of anti-racist work, and specifically within the context of public health. So that will be a key function and role of this new position. So I'm really, really excited that over the next 2 to 3 months, as we develop and recruit for that position, that we'll be able to onboard that individual and really turbocharge this work. That in combination with some of our strategic planning, I think it's just going to be fantastic. So I'm excited to see some of the new developments over the next 2 to 3 months. Sorry about the dog thing. Any question?
I'd just like to add a comment, if I may. And Andrea is well aware of this. I occasionally get a question on equity, but I got about a dozen of them a couple, 3 weeks ago from a woman named Erica Martin, who's a licensed mental health counselor at Star Meadow. And signing with her were several other counselors from that organization. And so I thought, gee, I don't know the answer as to how public health is meeting all of these goals that had been set. So I asked Dr. Melnick, and he got right back with some great answers, which I then sent to her. But wouldn't you know, each question prompted about 4 more. And so I thought that was a terrific way for us to have what I think is a really great set of questions to explore on the subject of equity, not just because it's of interest to that particular group, but they're obviously an informed group and want to be more informed on the equity issue as it pertains to public health. So it's a win-win for all of us when we respond. But anyway, when I got this huge list of questions, I thought, I think we need some more help, and it probably ought to be oral discussions, not just a bunch of emails, because that would take forever to respond to in depth. So Andrea reached out to her, for which she was very grateful and really appreciated your contact there. And I think that kind of communication is really helpful to us in already knowing what the questions are that people really want the answers to, and we can just build on that. I don't know that I'll ever get so many questions again from a constituent, but when there are some, you can be sure that I will pass them on, and I know it becomes a part then of the story that we can tell, both in terms of what we're doing well in response to the equity issues and where there's room for improvement. So anyway, thanks to you, Dr. Milnick and Andrea, for your response to these questions that were very detailed.
It's an excellent question set, and I think what I can do next briefing, maybe in August or when there's time, is just review some of those questions and then how our dialogue goes in July, because like looking at the subset, the second set of questions that the group sent over, we have answers for all the questions, but it's there's contextual data and PDFs and stories that go with a lot of the questions that I think will be rich, and we can share excerpts of the webinar series and kind of just have time and space to do that deep dive. So then it's just not like a back and forth via email, and I think it's more personal. We can use that time to kind of solicit feedback, which I think is an ultimate goal. I think the more community organizations that we have shared understanding of the importance of this foundational element of our work, the better. So, just let me know if you have any questions in the interim, and should have another report out for this group in a couple months. So really looking forward to a lot of rich conversations and growth.
And I've got to tell you that public health is really the pack of all the departments on this, because I get to see what most of the departments, at least those who report to the county manager, are doing. And you guys are just able to articulate very, very well what you are accomplishing in this arena. And that is so important, and thank you for doing that. Other departments, I think, are doing a lot, but maybe haven't had that series of questions come in yet or whatever, because they haven't articulated yet the extent to which they are responsive to the community in this regard. So what you're doing is important, and thank you. And bless you.
Well, Andrea, I think you set up some meetings with them, correct? Or are you going to meet with that? Yeah. Have a more robust discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. And Andrea, thank you so much for all your work on racial equity. I would love to go more into a deep dive at one of our FAC meetings, and would love to hear more about the work and review those questions. Because I feel like I could certainly use more learning and, you know, education on what public health is doing and how this impacts our community. So we would love to make space for that, I think, in the next, you know, couple of meetings. So thank you.
Absolutely. Maybe we can do an executive planning session.
Great. So next up on the agenda is foundational public health services. Our team has organizational chart positions to review and for us to discuss. So I will I'll let our leadership team start discussing that.
Before we get to that, I just want to mention, I forgot to mention earlier when we were talking about Plan B, is Our nursing staff have noticed that there's been real challenges in for low-income women, including women on Medicaid, to be able to access condoms as well as Plan B. And we're basically trying to have conversations with the state to see if they can fix some of those access issues. So I forgot to mention that, but we've gotten really good feedback from our nurses who do home visits through, for example, through our nurse family partnership, that some of their families are having difficulty accessing both. So I'll try to keep you updated on that as well. Andrea, I don't know if you have anything to add on that. I forgot it earlier.
No,
I was thinking about that, and it ties in a nice, pretty tight loop around access to care and healthcare coverage issue for our pregnant and parent.
I think you're having a bad internet connection.
I think maybe just in the I'm trying to talk while I'm turning on my video. Yes, I feel like that would be a good use case for us to maybe review next time, just to make sure that we get through the new positions. But yeah, yep. I think it's an excellent use case scenario of how public health's role presents in terms of supporting our community members with navigating access, especially as it relates to Medicaid and managed care support. So yeah, huge public health implications there.
So I'm
going to face the intensiveness of pregnancy and then also sexually transmitted infection. So
sexually transmitted infections on the increase at the same time people having trouble getting access to condoms. So I'm going to go ahead and share the screen, and then I'll ask each of our leadership team members to comment on the organization chart as I advance it, if that would be okay. Is that okay? So let's see if my share screen works again. Can you see that? It should say, can you see the organization chart? So this is the first page. There's going to be more as I advance it. Okay, yeah, it moves. This is where we have the deputy director. Given all the and Council Chair Bowerman, once we find out exactly how much the state gives us the final numbers on the amount of money we're getting, we will be bringing this as a staff report to the county council for approval. But this will all be funded through the state, no county general fund. This is all state funded dollars for the legislature allocated for foundational public health services. So, but we wanted, because of FAC's role in terms of reviewing our budget and providing input, we wanted to bring it to FAC at this point, since you'll be hearing about this very soon. So, we're looking at, and Andrea already talked about the deputy director, but given the span of control we're having and the amount of new programs, really going to help with the deputy director, who will provide a lot of oversight over operations, including our helping move our strategic planning and our racial equity work forward. So that's here. We're also going to be beefing up. I don't know, Roxanne, if you want to talk to this about communications.
Sure. I hope you can hear me. I turned my camera off because my internet is being uncooperative. So if you can't hear me, let me know. The program coordinator too is actually somebody who is skilled in communications and will be really running the effort, the strategic planning around communications and that sort of a thing. And then under that person, we will have a communications specialist. We will be posting that as a specialist and a senior to see to be able to get the breadth of experience levels in there. So that role will then move to being under the deputy director and the administrator and health officer, Dr. Momek.
And the other thing is, we're going to be also hiring another deputy health officer. For a couple of things. One is we're spread pretty thin and covering five counties, but there's a lot of things we're not getting to. For example, and I don't want to go into too much detail, but more involvement in preventive interventions, like, for example, latent TB infection, but also really beefing up the interaction we have between public health and our healthcare providers, you know, for example, local physicians. So, and also making sure that we're effectively providing regional services with the other four county health departments. So, so that there's a deputy health officer there as well. Okay, I'm going to go to, I think this is Andrea's area. She's our community health director. So, Andrea, I don't know if folks can see this well. I'll try to enlarge it a little bit more, if that helps.
Yeah, that's good. Can everyone hear me? I was also having some internet difficulties. In terms of kind of the three service lines under the community health division, you can see in the darker orange area all six of our new positions that are funded through Foundational Public Health Services are over in our Healthy Communities service line. And that's largely because that's where most of our upstream work related to the FPHS capabilities and definitions takes place. So we will be onboarding a senior policy analyst, a number of program coordinators who will be working across the three content areas in the life course designation, which is inclusive of maternal child health, access to care. That's always be thinking of access to care. So when we talk about that, that's a really big key piece of foundational public health, and then chronic disease and violence and injury prevention. So we were able to secure funding for child death review and then also expand our ability to provide support to our community partners with health planning functions. So that's data collection, analysis, evaluation, and reporting. A lot of that strategic initiatives work in capacitating with community partnerships and development. And that Raising Clark County position is within the maternal child health service line. And that urban regional planner position will be doing some pretty cool, groundbreaking, kind of cross-cutting work with built environment, environmental public health, and then also schools and parks and those types of spaces. So very, very excited about this. It's a big opportunity for us.
Andrea, this is Maria. Are all of these positions here full-time?
So let me see.
It's on the bottom there.
All of the new positions are full-time. If you're looking at the complete portfolio, most of these are all 1.0 positions except for the program coordinator to nurse supervisor position over for CalLITs, and then everything else is, yes, these are 1.0 positions full-time.
Andrea, I guess the name Child Death Review Program Coordinator kind of explains what their subject is, but what in the world is going on? Do they have to do? What is this?
Sure. It's a great question. And for folks who are less familiar, in most states and as well as nationally, public health has jurisdiction and oversight for reviewing and analyzing circumstances for all cause and preventable causes of death for children ages birth to 18. And that's important for many reasons. So when you consider all of the things around you that roll up to public health policy, helmet laws, seatbelt laws, smoking laws, best practice on messaging for preventing hot car deaths, drownings, right? Safe sleep, sewage. It's around us all the time, right? And all of that prevention messaging and what we know to be true about best practice and research is actually grounded in multidisciplinary child death review. And Washington State historically has had unfunded statutory legislation specifically designating local public health jurisdictions as the convener of local allied groups that have investments in the pregnant parenting and, you know, early childhood and youth and adolescent community. But very recently we wrote a proposal that earmarks and sets aside funding that's tied to five-year rolling death rates, so it's indexed over time. So if you are living in a county or a jurisdiction that has a substantive amount of child deaths, you therefore get the funding to review those as a multidisciplinary group to see what's preventable, what trends prevent over time, are preventable over time, and how do we create policy and messaging to improve safety and reduce the prevalence and incidence of child death by type. Motor vehicle accidents, there's unfortunately lots of different preventable causes of death, and what makes our jurisdiction unique among all but one other county in the state is that public health also works with our Office of the Medical Examiner. So it's very critical work. It's important work, and it's often just not discussed or talked about because of the nature and the sensitivity of you know, what comes across the, you know, the agendas and the circumstances for the review.
When I was a health officer in Oregon, in Washington County, I sat on a child death review panel, and the medical examiner was part of that. We got a lot of really helpful information in terms of risk factors, and really learning from that, as Andrea articulated really well, about learning from each of these tragic preventable deaths to identify risk factors that we could end up leading to policy that could prevent them in the future.
That's really fascinating, and I did not know that the county had this type of position in the offing. Are the data submitted then to state, and then that goes to a national database type thing?
You nailed it. That's exactly what happens. And so when you look in, so then you can analyze trends at a state level and then nationally. And some of our best national policy and what we know to be true and how research evolves actually uses that national child death review prevention database. And then some states with more sophisticated funding streams also review kind of near death experiences to inform kind of accidents and preventable safety measures. So
I still those were 30 years ago. I still remember some of those cases, including things like carbon monoxide poisoning and a number of things that you would not. You learn a lot.
It's really important. And it's part of that life cycle work, and we do, we average, I want to say, 14 to 15 child deaths in this county a year. So it will be really, really important to make sure that each one of those deaths is reviewed through a prevention lens. Any other questions before we move
on to the next?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to move on. And this is, and the darker shade are obviously the additions. I'm going to let Roxanne cover this one. Let me see if I get that. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, I don't really necessarily have a lot of changes. I think that we had already discussed kind of pivoting our COVID response team, and now we're moving into, from case and contact investigation, we're really moving into more infection prevention. And not just for COVID, but for all preventable, for all notifiable conditions. And so really the focus will be on working with facilities, congregate facilities, such as long-term care facilities, skilled nursing facilities that have some significant risk factors, and really working with them to provide some infection prevention protocols that can hopefully prevent infectious disease outbreaks in the future. So one of the things we're doing under our infection prevention team is we're adding a program coordinator two and two more public health nurses that will aid in this work. And we have the highest, I think, number of adult family homes in our region. There are over 400, I believe, in our region. So we will be continuing to work with them too on infection prevention protocols. So that's hopefully as soon as we are able not only to confirm our funding, but as soon as we get the approval to move forward, we're going to be posting these positions. The infection disease and prevention and control team, same thing, we're adding two program coordinators to help coordinate this work. We've just seen a tremendous expansion of the requirements, not only under what we are, what we're doing to respond to infectious disease prevention, but also some reporting. And there's also going to be some regional work that has to be done per our the requirements from the state, along with the foundational public health services funding that we're getting. So we're adding those two positions there to help to coordinate the work and lead the work and prioritize what it is that we are working on. And then finally, under our emergency preparedness and response team, we're looking to hire two additional program coordinators to assist with our emergency response planning and work with our Region 4 and our healthcare alliance team members to be able to work on our not only our exercises, but our emergency response plans in the community. So those are all significant adds and will assist us in really kind of meeting the needs that we've got, not only in our immediate community, but also region-wide. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell. Does anybody have any questions?
I just wanted to add one thing, Roxanne, on the state. Mm-hmm. And thanks to the work that Roxanne and her team is doing, the state is viewing us as a regional hub for, correct me if I'm wrong, for both infection prevention as well as tuberculosis. And we're getting, I believe we're getting additional funding beyond what we'd ordinarily get because we're a hub. We're a regional hub for those two areas. Am I correct?
That's correct. You are correct, sir.
By the way, around TB, tuberculosis, it's us and Seattle that are the two regional hubs. And I think infection prevention, there's only a couple of regional hubs in the state, and we're one of those as well.
I have a quick question. Roxanne, in the HIV STD prevention, did I hear correctly that you're going into long-term care facilities and helping to prevent those diseases in those?
So, say that again, Amy. Sorry.
I'm curious whether your HIV STD prevention program includes people who live in long-term care facilities.
I see what you're saying. Good question. That is notifiable, and we do outreach along with some of our provider.
You're breaking up, Roxanne. I wonder if I can help handle this one, if that's okay.
With regard to when we meet in a.
Yeah, okay. So the infection prevention program that's mainly going to be working, you know, doing a lot of work with the long-term care facilities is working on a lot of things like health care associated infections that are found often in long-term care facilities like C. difficile, other infections that are Candida, auris, and things like that that are found. And actually, in terms of bloodborne pathogens, you know, accidents happen there as well in terms of long-term care facilities. So we'll be doing work around bloodborne pathogens as well in terms of infection control. A lot of the work around HIV and STD is we're seeing unprecedented increases in chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis, including, well, we haven't, recently, in the last few years, I believe we have had congenital syphilis in Clark County, but that a lot of that work is to increase our efforts around, specifically around HIV and STD, because we're seeing more STD numbers have drastically increased. I wouldn't consider the, you know, the bloodborne pathogen prevention is important, including Hep B, Hep C, and HIV, including in long-term care facilities, but those are not really high-risk settings generally for sexually transmitted disease, but our community is. We're seeing a lot more of it. I don't know if that answers the question, Amy.
It does, but I would just like to add that if you're looking at these situations by age, I think that there probably is a lot more HIV and STD in people over 65 than we've looked at.
Well, hopefully we should have more of the capacity to address those, including, you know, epidemiology capacity.
Okay, thank you.
Roxanne, are you back on? Did you want to add anything, or did I miss, or was I, did I miss anything there?
No, I apologize. My internet connection is very unfit. Thank you.
Any other questions for this area? Okay, I'm going to move us to environmental public health, and I'll turn it over to Brian.
Let's see, where to start. So the gray boxes you'll see are scattered. They're not in the straight row, and those represent program titles. So I'll just jump in. We're creating some program capacity. The first two boxes you'll see under the food program, PC1 and an EHS2. The EHS2 is going to focus on plan review. Specifically, the food program's seen a growing need and really no slowdown in plan review and development through the community. And the PC is going to be put in place just to support the program. So this is currently a 16-person program and one program manager. This is going to build capacity for that program manager to work with the community a little bit closer. And these two positions specifically are covered by fees. So they will not be covered by FPHS. It's just built into the fee structure. And then moving over, we have community health protection. This is a five-program bucket. So we have solid waste enforcement, rec water safety, school health and safety, pollution prevention assistance, and hazard assessment. Five programs, five budgets, a number of different state grants, federal grants, and fees. And so we're building a PC1 into that to just help with programmatic support. Jeff decided no, the PC in the budget under food and PC is not a PC1, same as Kimberly's PC. I need to read that note again, PC.
Sorry, those are Program Coordinator 2 positions?
Program Coordinator 2 positions, yeah.
Thank Sorry you, about Jeff. That.
No, that's okay. Let's see. So we'll jump over to the SWEO team is the next addition that we have. This is a planner position, a relatively new addition to the org chart. This is to address the growing need in our solid waste system to help with the planning of our garbage, recycling, and yard debris. And moving forward, we're looking at negotiating new contracts with Waste Connections, looking the next 10 years and further. And so to help with the future planning of that, this is not funded by foundational public health funding. This is built into an existing grant and capacity they had with the staffing. The most exciting, I think, around FPHS is the addition of a new program. And this is what we're calling Environmental Outreach, Science, and Policy. This program is going to have positions that support all of EPH programs in areas that are so greatly needed that we haven't been able to focus on in many years. So first, we have a program manager, one, to just oversee the programs and support the positions. We have a health educator that starts July 1. This is foundational year one foundational funding. This is going to be outreach and education around all of our environmental programs. Environmental epidemiologist. This person will be supporting all programs, looking at outcomes and exposures of interest, tying it back to the program work, really helping to tell the story, identify different areas that the program should be collecting data on. Currently, every program is collecting quite a bit of data that we're just not using to tell the story of what the work is that we do and tying it to outcomes. So this position is going to focus on that, and a special focus also on environmental equity. An area we don't have a lot of capacity to focus on right now. So we're all really excited to see what this position grows into over the next several months. And then zoonotics, and this is a zoonotics and vector-specific program. What I want to note of this is we will not be focusing on vector or zoonotic-borne diseases. That's something our communicable disease team does, but we'll be focusing on best management practices, pest management practices, support for schools and restaurants on how to keep vectors and zoonotics out of those sensitive areas, which is really a huge need, and also responding to a lot of complaints. We get a surprisingly number of complaints about bed bugs and just helping folks identify what do you do with bed bugs, how do you get rid of them, how do you prevent them, and so I'll leave it there. Is there any questions about those additions?
Okay, I'll move us down to the next, and this is administrative services, this is part of FDHS because it includes competencies and capabilities in this area. I'll let Jeff go ahead and take us through this.
Thank you. All right, so we started the 2020 budget process with 121.3 FTE. We are finishing our 2023 budget process with 181.8 FTE. So we have more than a 50% increase in staffing. So business competencies and internal services or central services definitely need to follow suit to provide sufficient services to our department. We're breaking apart performance management, quality improvement, and general administration from the box to the far right. We have a program manager one right now with all of our IS, IT, our grants and contracts, our records management, including responding to public records requests, also has performance management, quality improvement, and general admin under her. So we're actually breaking apart a piece of her body of work and creating a new program manager one position that will oversee all of those things. We're creating a new program coordinator one and a new program assistant. In addition, with performance management, quality improvement, the general administration, we're going to centralize a lot of admin services that were decentralized in difficult budget times many years ago. Inventory and management, assisting with coordination of onboarding new employees, offboarding employees, etc. We're also adding what's called CHAP, which is Community Health Accounts Payable. We're adding an Office Assistant 3 that does the accounts payable work for the department. A group of staff also does medical billing, so any Medicaid, Medicare, private insurance billing also comes out of that shop. And lastly, we're adding an operations management analyst, which will primarily take financial reporting off of my plate, actually. So we're actually creating capacity for myself and my financial operations manager by shifting some work around. I've been here since we were down to as low as 80 FTE. Now we're back up to over 180, and we need to have more support in central services so we can support the department. Any questions on admin services? I will say, being here since the late 90s, it was very, very difficult to see loss of resources for many, many years, and seeing the support for public health return. It's huge. I have what I call a passion bucket. It keeps me going in this field. And seeing that funding, it just keeps that passion bucket full. So
Jeff, do you guys have an HR manager?
Human resources is actually a central support function of the county.
Okay.
I would say all of LT, all of our leadership team liaisons with our human resources department.
We presented this to our HR department and all these additions that we're talking about, and including these organizational charts, and we received strong support from HR for this. But we wanted to certainly share it with BAC and get your input. You know, I'm going to stop sharing unless people want to go back to it so we can see each other. But certainly wanted to, you know, and you'll be advising the Board of Health as well. And we got our Board of Health chair here. So I wanted, she gets a preview, but also get us to hear from you as well. Any other thoughts? Or I know we went through that pretty quickly.
Jeff, did you want to give us a budget update as well?
The primary budget update was the staffing org charts we went through. Those are the major position additions. That's the big part of our budget update for 2023. I do want to talk quickly, though, about we've had discussions with the leadership team about doing sort of a budget 101 or sort of a budget process review with FAC this fall and even into early next year. So when the annual budget process comes around next year, you'll have more of a basis, more of a baseline understanding of our process. This is brand new. This House Bill 1152 that passed that gave FAC the role to advise on the budget process. It hit everybody quickly, and there was not a lot of time to develop tools. We're having conversations about that process this fall.
Hey Jeff, you're going to go into the fees also.
Yes.
Correct?
Yeah. Fees okay. is the next part. We had our one-on-one. So our fee process is we have one-on-ones with the county. With the Board of Health, which is also the county council. We then present fee scenarios to the TAC, our technical advisory committees. They represent industry, and then we bring it to FAC tonight, and then we have a work session with the Board of Health next Wednesday, July 6th. So I'm going to just share briefly where we're at with the where the fees are at based on our model. Can everyone see my screen?
By the way, Jeff, I just want to add one. We had one-on-ones with the Board of Health members, the County Council members. That was we're not seeking approval for anything. We are seeking just guidance from them in terms of moving it forward moving it forward towards a work session. So I just want to make sure I added that in there.
Yes, definitely not a vote. It was a presentation to show the scenario that we're at now and if they wanted to see other scenarios at that work session. Yes, very, very good, Ellen. So we presented what was adopted as Board of Health policy last October, and that is 100% cost recovery in all programs except drinking water safety and on-site septic permitting. Those are the two programs that are heavily reliant on construction, and when there is economic downturn, those programs suffer greatly, and there's not revenue to do that greater good work, complaint investigations, et cetera. As you'll see, actually, there's a collective reduction in fee revenue of 2.73%. It's $132,000 reduction in fees. However, you do see fees going up in some programs. It's going down in food safety, and food safety is by far the biggest program in this unit or division. So that's why you see, while four programs are going up, the collective is actually a reduction in fees. Since there's not a change in cost recovery recommended at any program level, that's why the fees are not going to be jumping all over the place like we've seen in the prior years. If there's any questions on the fees themselves, I can take them. I want to reiterate again, our fee process has been reviewed by the state auditors a few times, and it's always been given support by them.
Any questions? We're happy to give you additional detail if you want, but
there's a few hundred fees, so I try to keep it as succinct as possible by not going through 11 pages of different fees.
But the bottom line is what we've done over the last few years in moving towards full cost recovery is that we basically, down the road from year to year, if there's any changes, they're going to be relatively small. And actually this year, we're seeing an overall, when you look at all the fees together, we're seeing an overall reduction in fees.
Is that an actual reduction in the fee itself or a reduction in applications so there's lower fees?
So the fees are calculated based on projected volume, and what would cause – several things can impact fees. And if fees are going down and our costs were staying flat, what we'd be projecting actually is an increase in volume. So there's more people paying to cover the program. So you're dividing that program cost over a larger swath, so it actually would be an increase in volume. Excellent question. Well, there's no other questions. I will stop sharing my screen as well.
Okay. Any other questions about foundational public health or the budget before we move on to the next item on our packed agenda for today?
Are folks generally supportive? I know we went through this really quickly. Any concerns?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Dr. Melnick. I forgot to ask. We are soliciting if there is support from FACT to present the fee model as presented tonight at the work session next Wednesday. In other words, it's FACT supportive. It's the same policy Board of Health approved last October for the fee table process.
So I just want to say that it's very heartening to see the strategy behind the request that you have for these additional positions, and I think that with the kinds of roles that you're going to include, you'll have a very robust public health department and be able to do the things that you've been wanting to do but unable to do sometimes in the past. So I'm totally supportive of the way that you're planning to utilize the funds that you'll receive and really create the ability to provide foundational public health support in addition to many other things that you do.
I just appreciate the way you presented it tonight within the org chart, the new positions and where they land. That was helpful for me, and I approve what I saw.
Yeah, as we get better at doing this, and we do this from year to year, I know Jeff is going to take you into more budget stuff this fall, but we'll be continuing to, share information like this with FACT. I know it's a lot quickly. This new statute around FACT's role just became, law this year. So it's a steep learning curve here.
I wanted to add that I want to thank everyone in public health for taking a very complicated budget and really making it very accessible to us. And I'm looking forward to Budget 101 and learning more about how this works. But I'm 100% supportive of this. Okay. All right. Well, Dr. Melnick, I believe you are up again to talk about public health ethics review of the Free Bridge program.
Great. So I'm going to wing this without looking at notes or anything because I've had this pretty well ensconced in my head. So we do have a public health ethics committee, which is made up of community members as well as some of our staff, but more community members and staff. And they provide when issues come up that might be related to how we use enforcement, our authority, or issues come up about resource allocation, like, how we allocate ventilators or vaccine, or questions come up about potential conflict of interest. That came up in the past, you might recall. We had pharmaceutical companies sponsoring immunization coalition luncheons, and we deliberated about that. We bring our ethics committee together, not only the members, but depending on the issue, we'll bring in community members as ad hoc stakeholders. I remember we were deliberating about whether vaping should be allowed indoors in public places, and we actually brought the vaping community in for that as stakeholders in that discussion. So we've been, our ethics committee has deliberated about a number of issues. And so the Free Fridge issue came up. So what Free Fridge is a very well-intentioned program. I believe it's a national movement where people, concerns about food insecurity, unhoused folks who don't have access to food, or people who generally may be neighbors but are food insecure, that people can put refrigerators out in their yards and stock the refrigerators with food and leave the refrigerators open so people who are food insecure can actually gain access to these refrigerators and get food. And actually people can put food in as well. It came up, I believe there are three of them in Clark County right now. The issue came, became even more, open when, the Vancouver City Council, the Vancouver City, was taking a look at their ordinance. Previously, the ordinance, in the city of Vancouver would, not allow free fridges in the front of somebody's, lot. And previously they were on the side of the lot. Now they want to put them more prominently in the front yard of homes that people could go by. We became concerned because the practice, basically, when you're providing food to the public, there's a state food code, and we became concerned that the practice itself, while incredibly well-intentioned, could actually put people, including vulnerable folks, people who might have underlying health conditions, you know, given their, you know, that they might be unhoused or have food insecurity, put them at risk of foodborne illness. Precisely because there's no, it's not that, you know, these refrigerators are not people are not just stocking them with, for example, prepackaged, pre-wrapped food, but they're also potentially stocking them with food prepared at home, including, you know, things like leftovers that are subject to not only unsafe food handling processes, but a temperature control. Anyway, we got concerned that there was a risk to foodborne illness. And our staff went out and took a look, our food staff, and I'll let, after I'm done here, I'll let Brian add anything onto this, did take a look at the fridges and found concerns about what was being stocked in them. And so this led us, you know, given that this is something that there's a lot of support for in the community, but also the concerns that we had, we figured, but also the fact that there's only three of these right now. I know there's more in the Seattle area, but we're looking at the risk to the community about foodborne illness versus a benefit. We thought this would be an opportunity to convene our ethics committee, involve community stakeholders, including at this ethics deliberation, we would include people from the city of Vancouver as well as the free fridge folks, some of the people who are involved in this program, as well as other community stakeholders. We want opportunity for input from diverse stakeholders, including people who work with unhoused and food insecure populations, as well as people who work with the food banks, as well as we want to make sure that we have enough perspectives, include BIPOC community members and organizations as well in this deliberation. So we wanted to run it by FAC. You are certainly community stakeholders, but our plan is to have our ethics committee review this, and we're not ceding the public health authority to the ethics committee, but we do appreciate their input. And we think that having a transparent community deliberation about the free fridge program hopefully will come to some sort of maybe a third position or a middle position or some process that we believe maximizes safety and minimizes foodborne risk, and that, you know, by being involved in the process, this transparent process, we actually can build community trust. So we wanted to run that by you. I apologize for going on and on about that, but we're looking at having this. Now we're putting a list, an invitation list of community stakeholders. FAC members are certainly welcome. And then we would invite people and probably have this enough time to have this deliberation sometime in late July or early August. So that's kind of where we're at. I wanted to run that by FAC and see what you all thought.
I have a question about would these refrigerators potentially be in private individuals' yards at their home?
That's exactly where they are.
Yeah. And so in that case, is there a liability for the homeowner should the food be contaminated or something and someone get ill? Or what about, are refrigerators still a risk for child suffocation? I mean, what about those?
Yeah. Marla, those are great questions. So, I'm not an expert. I'm not a legal expert. By the way, we will include, unfortunately, we were going to use a Peace Health ethicist, but she left Peace Health, so we need to locate another ethicist. And we're one of the members of our ethics committee is our prosecuting attorney's office as well, because questions come up. In terms of liability, yes, but, you know, it is a potential liability for the homeowner. And I don't know, again, I'm not a legal expert, but I doubt that homeowner's insurance would cover something like this. I know the free fridge folks, the national organization says you don't have to worry about liability. I had a brief discussion with the county prosecuting attorney who said they're not legal experts. So, so there is a potential liability for the homeowner. And now I forgot what the second part of your, the children and suffocating. I believe, and Brian, you can correct me because you guys took a look at this. I believe they have safeguards in place to prevent children from being locked in these refrigerators.
Most new fridges do have safeguards in place. However, being on site, I can tell you one of the fridges is pretty old. And it is open and there's no safeguard. Two of the fridges we saw, there are locks that are above the 48 inches that you would require, like getting into a pool as a 48 inch height. And so, that is a concern that we want to address. And Alan, I will tell you that I've spoken with multiple insurance companies. I'm trying to get a representative to participate in the deliberation just from that perspective. And we do have, we are also reaching out to the neighborhood groups, the neighborhood associations to get community members there that live around these fridges to participate as well.
Yeah, great idea. I didn't think of inviting the insurance company, but one of the things you try to do in these deliberations is you want to make sure you're inclusive as possible and you involve as subject matter experts when necessary. And the insurance person is an example of a subject, as well as our prosecuting attorney.
Are there three individuals involved who provide these fridges, are they plugging them in and keeping the temperature at some specified level that is controlled?
I'll let Brian take that. I'm happy to join in.
They are, and they actually have a fairly robust group that goes fridge to fridge on a routine basis and checks temperatures of the freezer and the fridge. And I can tell you over the hot weekend, they set corrected, self-monitored, and they shut the fridges down. We're not sure if it's because they reached an unsafe level or if they weren't confident that they could maintain temperature. But all food inside, if it does reach an unsafe temperature for any extended period of time, needs to be thrown away.
Do we know whether they did that or not, Brian?
Because we don't inspect them. This is really a gray area for food code. Of what our role is and should be, which is why we're deliberating on this. And I think our path forward will be a little bit more clear after this. And one thing I want to add is Seattle King has 6 or 7 of these in their area. They are popping up in other counties, and no one knows what to do with them. The Fridge program, which is the larger program in the state, has a guidance document that says get so large that it's a political nightmare for local health to take this on. And that's what's happened in Seattle King. So meeting with other environmental health directors, they are looking at us and the process we're going through to help advise what their steps are. And they're very excited that we've taken this on and they didn't have to.
Hey, Brian, we also invited, I believe we're going to have somebody from DOH join the deliberation as well. So their environmental folks at State Health Department will be. We may have to break into small groups. I'm wondering how this is going to work because we have a lot of stakeholders, but we can make it work.
We have at this point, Alan, about 65 folks that are going to participate.
Oh, boy. Okay. This may take a good half day to do, and I'm thinking that we'll need several we'll plan it. We'll need several facilitators and breaking up into small groups and then coming back together. I've done that before. I've been writing and doing work around public health ethics for a couple of decades. So I've seen it work with large groups, but you have to break up into smaller. We can make it work.
Will you be doing it remotely, like via Zoom, or are you going to do it in person?
Great question. I think my gut feeling, and that wasn't meant as a pun, but is that it would be better in person if we could do it in a large, you know, large venue and break up into small groups. But, you know, it really depends on what's happening COVID-wise when we do this. We can, you know, the nice thing about some of these technologies like Zoom and all that is you can actually have breakout rooms and break up into small groups. So we can make it work remotely if we have to. What do you all think?
Sounds like it's going to be a very thorough process. And Cassie has her hand up. Cassie, go ahead.
I would just say that I know that COVID cases are going up. I know in our community we have had an incredible increase. And although it has mutated down, it still is making some people critically sick. And so I just feel like I think it's hard for people, but we really need to accept, like, hybrid options as, like, a thing moving forward. And I think if COVID cases are, you know, bad and they're being seen, that it's, you know, we should at least have public health do the right thing. And I completely agree with the Zoom.
And I might add, Cassie, you broke up, but Cassie is an ICU nurse, and I believe you are. And I know you're seeing the consequences. I know our hospitals are pretty busy right now, so I completely agree. If there's any question about COVID rates and safety, we can do this remotely or we can wait.
I think doing it remotely provides easier access for people who don't have transportation, and I'm assuming you're going to have people from food insecure communities be part of this discussion as well, not just the organizations that serve them, but the actual folks who are experiencing food insecurity. Will they be invited?
Yes, but see, that's the issue with the technology as well, because the technology provides increased access for some folks, but decreased access for other people in our for example, people who are unhoused. But yeah, that would be the idea. When I've screwed this up before, it's because it wasn't inclusive enough and didn't identify stakeholders that we really needed there. So there are pluses and minuses in terms of access when you're using this technology. I'll have to think about that. It'd be great. You know, my dream is that COVID goes away, which won't happen, and we could do this in person. But, you know, we might have to think about ways that we can involve people. If we do it virtually, ways that we can involve people who don't have the technology, but way we can get them plugged in somehow.
I think I heard Cassie say, what about a hybrid option? Would that be possible? It might mean that people who are doing it electronically wouldn't have the same experience, but they might still be able to participate. So I don't know how hard that would be to do, but it might be a compromise.
There are challenges with that. We may have the technology at the Center for Community Health to do that, but we'll have to work and look into that.
You know, just thinking about the program overall, and how some people keep their food. This kind of gives me a nightmare with what all the things are that could happen by well-intended people. And, you know, I think about some of the programs that exist that are really very well run and are checked, like LULAC's program for giving out freshly grown produce, some of the food banks, and it would change it completely, I know. But I just wonder if some of the free fridge concept couldn't be incorporated into those formats.
If they were just giving out food like, you know, providing food like LULAC does in terms of the produce and all that, we would be having a very different discussion. We're talking about people preparing like casseroles, I think I heard lasagna in their homes and then putting them in the fridges. We're talking about complex food handling processes. That's what is concerning. Well-meaning, but concerning.
Yeah. So I'll register my concern, strong concern. When I bring things to the Battleground Food Bank, they check the, you know, dates on cans. They don't want something that's best by date has passed. And I think that's how it should be. But I really do have some, and they wouldn't accept home prepared food. So it really does concern me. It's a wonderful idea if it could be done under the same rigor as a food bank, the way they're run, but that's probably not practical.
You know, if you want to check, you can go to freedge.org. It's freedge.org. Okay. I believe that's their website, and you can read about what they're about.
I love the concept, but it sounds like it's a little bit Wild West right now and not well organized to feel comfortable, for me to be comfortable.
And Tyler, just so you know, Eric Holmes he's aware of this, and we've invited City of Vancouver to participate in this.
If you all do go to the Fridge website, know that that is a different organization than Vancouver Free Fridge. Vancouver Free Fridge has said they're not willing to participate and abide by the rules because Fridge does say that you should not cook food in your home, and it should be store prepared or restaurant prepared, and that's the foundation. A Vancouver Free Fridge is cook in your home, bring your leftovers.
Yeah, we're talking leftovers here. Yeah, Amy?
So
Oh, wait.
I just had a quick question for Brian. Is there data from King County of anyone reporting, like, food poisoning from eating stuff from the Free Fridge?
Great question. So, no, and the reason we expect that is because they're serving a population that is really unlikely to report a foodborne illness in general. So it's a vulnerable population that historically, I believe, not just I believe, this is a sense in the community that food that goes in this population doesn't need to meet the same standard of food that we would expect to eat ourselves. And however well-intentioned, that is something that we, I think, need to change as a cultural norm, that it is not a substandard that goes to this population. They deserve the same quality, same standard, and same expectations of safety as we do.
So just in terms of foodborne illness, in the United States is grossly underreported, way underreported. So first of all, somebody has to get exposed. They have to develop symptoms. The symptoms have to be severe enough for them to go to a doctor's office. The doctor has to recognize that it's potentially a foodborne illness. Don't get me started on that. They have to do the right tests, and the tests have to be done, have to come out positive. So and we're dealing, as Brian said, with it's enough for people who are housed to be diagnosed, but somebody who's unhoused, soul is alone. You know, if you have a party or something and a bunch of people get sick, it's easy to recognize. But if you have individuals who don't speak to each other or communicate with each other and don't have access to health care and they get foodborne illness, it's virtually impossible to identify. You know, it's not impossible, but the likelihood, that's the other concern, that we won't, you know, we'll miss it and won't pick it up, and potential danger there as well.
Well, I know this has been a really great discussion, but we are 15 minutes over, so I'm sorry that we're over time, but we will certainly, you know, can plan to continue this discussion at our next meeting. I know there was another item on the agenda about scheduling public comments, so we'll make sure we get to that, get that to the top of the agenda at our next August 23rd will be our next meeting. So thank you all for such a healthy and great discussion on a lot of different topics today. So see you in August, and happy 4th of July to everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.